Thank you for tuning in to KBVR Corvallis. I'm Donald Orr. For the next hour, you'll be listening to a pre-recorded interview with Dr. Randall Milstein, an astronomy instructor, a part of the physics department here at OSU, and the astronomer-in-residence for the Oregon-NASA Space Grant Consortium. Orange Media Network's web and mobile manager, Gabriel Shields, got a chance to sit down with Dr. Milstein to talk about the science surrounding the upcoming solar eclipse and how to view it safely. Hi, you're listening to KBVR Corvallis, and we have a very special show today. We are here with Dr. Randall Milstein of the OSU Astronomy Department.
The physics department.
Physics department. So, thank you for joining us. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a faculty member here at Oregon State University. I teach astronomy in the physics department. Also have appointments in the University Honors College, as well as the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. And I'm also the astronomer in residence for the Oregon-NASA Space Grant Consortium.
Awesome. So what got you interested in physics and astronomy in the first place? What inspired you?
Actually, I started out as a Earth scientist, and I got involved in studying impact craters. And from there, that evolved into astrogeology, the geology and processes of other planets. And that was the real inspiration for studying astronomy.
That's great. So now we're kind of in this special time right now. This month we have a big event. Everybody's talking about the eclipse. And I know that you have pretty much been like the man of the hour this month. Let's talk about that a little bit. This eclipse here, what makes this event so special?
It's in a couple different ways. One is this is the first eclipse that will cross the entire continental United States since 1918. We've had some other eclipses, of course, over the years, but they've only been in portions or swaths through the country. This crosses the entire Pacific to Atlantic coasts. And one of the other things very interesting about it is that in that swath, the path of totality is only about 65 or 70 miles wide, but there will be 12 million Americans or people in the United States who can see it in that swath. But another 324 million Americans live within 900 miles of that. So that's a easy day's drive if you push it.
Definitely.
Which would make it the most viewed natural phenomena in the history of America.
That's insane. That's amazing. So, and the last one you said was in 1918.
That actually went the entire width of the country. Yes.
Okay, cool. So when would we expect to see another event like this? This magnitude?
This magnitude, wow. I'd have to go and really check the charts. Mm-hmm. But I know we will have another eclipse that will go through from Texas up towards the northeast coast in 2024.
Oh, cool. So now we're talking a solar eclipse, and then we're talking totality. Now there are different types of eclipses.
Yes, there are four different types of eclipses. Just under 30% of them are total eclipses. There's a little over 30% are partial eclipses, where only part of the sun is blocked by the moon. There are annular eclipses, which is when the moon is at apogee rather than perigee, and it doesn't fill the whole disk of the sun, so you see an edge around it. And then there's a very low number, less than 5%, of what are called hybrid eclipses, where eclipse starts out as one thing, and because of its motion and the motion of the Earth, turns into one of the other style of eclipses.
Oh, great. So what is it that makes it where there are so many different types? You kind of briefly mentioned apogee versus perigee. And so why do we get all these different various types?
Well, it's because the position of the moon. The moon is not in a circuit orbit. It's an ellipse around our planet. And also our orbit around the sun is an ellipse. So it puts us at quite different distances at different times. And why the eclipse is a somewhat rare event is because it requires the sun, the moon, and the Earth to be in specific positions at specific times so that they match up.
That's awesome. So
Is there any other planetary body that actually is able to see a totality like this? I know that there are other planets that probably have eclipses, but do any of them actually reach totality? Or are we the only one? Or
if we define totality as we see it, that the moon totally occults the sun and you're able to see the corona, it's just us. Now, of course, Mercury and Venus don't have moons, so they don't have eclipses. Now, other planets do have eclipses. I have a image that I show when I go around and give talks about eclipses of Jupiter with 5 eclipses happening at one time.
Oh,
and
man.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Because the moons are lined up and they block the sun and they cast a shadow on the upper cloud deck of Jupiter. The difference is, though, is Jupiter is so far away, their moons are pretty good sized, you know, one of them being the largest moon in the solar system, that they would completely block the sun out so that, and because of the great distances, you don't see the corona then. It's just the magnitude is not such, and the moon is so large it completely occults even what you might see. So any world with a moon, it is a good enough size, will be able to have an eclipse.
Awesome, awesome. So we just happen to have a moon that is like that specific perfect distance to be have an apparent size to block the sun.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. We have total eclipses as we see them now only for about the last 5% of Earth history. In the past, our moon was slightly closer to the Earth, and the sun was, in its luminescent size, smaller. And right now, we're just in a position where the size of the moon is 400 times roughly the size of the sun. It's just smaller. And that the distance between the Earth and the moon is roughly 400 times the distance between the moon and the sun. Now, in the future, our moon slowly is moving away from us at very fractions of an inch. It's not anything big, so don't worry about the moon going away. And at the same time, our sun expands its size about 10% every billion years. So wow. The moon will grow smaller as the sun grows bigger. And don't worry about it. We're talking about 900 million years or something. And at that time, anyone left on the Earth would only see annular eclipses.
Okay. So this event is going to be quite spectacular. It's going to inspire a lot of awe, I would imagine. What do you think about that as far as on a personal level? What throughout history, we've seen these, and you say this is an event that has happened and really ties us throughout history. So what do you think people kind of experience during an event like this, and what do you think they should be kind of thinking about and tying to that history?
Well, it's very interesting, as you mentioned, as a social phenomena, that people will see a total eclipse. They see totality. Sometimes people cry. Some people sing. They dance. They'll just stand with their jaw hanging open. They'll fall back and just sit on the ground and stare. You have other people who may play musical instruments. They may bang on drums. They have all kinds of ways to express themselves. But I think for me, the important thing is that as long as there have been humans on this planet, we've had total solar eclipses. And to experience that, as we're going to on August 21st, I think who you're with becomes very important. Your friends, your family, your colleagues, and that you have that shared memory, cultural memory then. And when we think that that's a link that combines us with all the other people throughout history who have witnessed these solar eclipses, they've either been awed in many cases. It was a very fearful time for many cultures. And that is a common thread that links us all the way back. I think when we have those common moments of our humanity, they become potent in our experience as human beings.
That's great. That's awesome. With something like this, where you're talking about, it's a very social event. We're all going to be observing. I mean, millions of people are going to be looking at the same thing at the same time. We have, you know, we're living in a modern age where we kind of more fully understand what is happening. How do you think that changes our experience as opposed to someone, you know, in an ancient time that didn't really fully understand what was happening, but had to make assumptions?
That's a great, great question, Gabriel. And it was asked to me not too long ago by someone else about how people interpret eclipses. And when you read the history of these, it's very interesting that there is a group of cultures who reacted to eclipses in a fear-based manner. They're very frightened. And a lot of that it was because they were told to be frightened. People were saying, well, I'm going to make the sun disappear because you're not doing what I want.
Right.
Or you haven't appeased the gods. Now, the only way you can do that is to pleasure, you know, the gods, or to make me happy and I'll make the sun come back. And of course, it's going to come back no matter what. It's a natural phenomenon. But if you knew that, you became a very powerful person or powerful within your culture. Then you have another group of people who reacted to eclipses quite differently. I think of the Southwest America's Native peoples, First Americans, had a completely different way of looking at it. It was a natural phenomenon. It was just part of nature. Hmm. You're part of nature, and your reaction was to say, during this very special moment, you don't eat or drink food. You're just supposed to sit back for the few minutes and contemplate your relationship to the universe. And they understood as well, and they say in their culture, that if you were to look at the eclipse when it was happening, your life would go out of balance. And that in the future, you would probably have medical problems, especially your vision would be affected, which, of course, we know it does if you look at the sun. The Aboriginal peoples of Australia, also, it was not a scary thing. It was a joyous time. It was when Moon Man and Sun Woman were able to come together and for a brief time engage in intimacies. And so it was not a thing to be feared. And I think that's a really interesting way to look at it. And now with science, we know that it's something not to be feared. It's to be curious about and then to enjoy as I think, part of that shared human, you know, cultural experience we all have.
There's a reverence to it now.
Exactly. At least I think so. I think you'll see people celebrate differently. I'm sure there'll be plenty of videos and things around about certain people who want to dance and beat drums and sing songs and raise up flowers and things to the sky. Other people, again, will be frightened. There are still people who are very frightened of these things. Or people like me are just curious and just want to see the stunning beauty of this. This is accredited in many cases to be the single most physically beautiful natural phenomena that you can witness.
Wow. Wow. Well, we're really in for a treat.
I hope so.
So these cultures that use this as a mechanism for control, how were they, how do you assume that they were able, or how do we know as historians were able to understand that things were going to come back? Did they surround themselves with astronomers of that time? Or, I mean, how are they measuring these things?
Well, we look back and we have to understand that right now we go home at night, and if we don't have anything to do, we can read a book, watch television, play video games, listen to the radio. They didn't have that back then. So when night came, you're pretty limited to what your options were. And so observing the sky was a common thing. In many cultures, they had people specifically set aside to do that. They originally became astrologers, fortune tellers. They weren't really astronomers. But they did observe, and they kept very meticulous records. We see this in many of the Asian cultures. We see this in India. We see it in African cultures. We see it in the Americas. We see it in Europe, that these people observed and kept very tight records of what they saw. One of the interesting things about eclipses is that there is a sun-moon-earth cycle called the Saros cycle that lasts 18 years, 11 days, and 8 hours. Now, the ancient people knew about this cycle. I know that the Celtic people especially have a stone megaliths that revolve around this, but they only knew it was 18 years and 11 days because they didn't have clocks to get those extra 8 hours. And so after a while, you could get into a rhythm, if you've observed for generations, of knowing this cycle and say, well, I can predict that this event is going to happen. In the case of eclipses, the problem is not having those 8 hours, because it means that when your prediction happens, the eclipse is actually 120 degrees west around the Earth from you. It's a full third of a day or a third of the Earth. So while you might be able to predict an eclipse coming, you couldn't necessarily predict its location. It would be 120 degrees to the west and pretty much 5 degrees north of where it should be as well. Oh. But even then, if you could predict that one might happen, it doesn't happen where you are. Some travelers then visit where you live and say there was this eclipse. You can still say, see, I predicted it. And that it, when you have those kind of powers, it makes you a very important person in your culture.
It's fascinating. When did this all change? When did we start to really understand? I'm sure different cultures started to understand this at a different time, but when do you think it really changed where we started to understand that this was a celestial phenomenon? And
well, I think people at the, it depends on where you are on the planet. There were certain cultures that suppressed astronomical observations purposely as, again, a matter of control for many, many years because they would conflict with whatever the current philosophy was. And so while you might have a culture in the Middle East or Asia or South America where this was pretty much known information, you move to Europe, and for a period of time until the Renaissance and even into the Renaissance, that information was suppressed. Your basic dictates of your belief system said that there can't be change in the sky. It's just a set thing. And when these changes occurred, it raised a lot of questions. And people didn't like questions for a while. In other cultures, it was free to do those questionings.
Did this open up more ability for us to look at other changes within the sky? Were there other changes that were happening that people started to look at and go, oh, this is
very much so, Gabriel. It was just that for a period of time, when that occurred, your life might be at risk if you were to speak about it, and especially if you were to write about it. We could ask Copernicus, Giordano Bruno, and Galileo.
So we should be careful right now what we talk about, huh?
No. Hopefully our cultures have moved way beyond that, and yeah. Our freedom of thought and our freedom to express those, especially in our country, is still safe.
It's quite amazing that we get to study this phenomenon and then also think about, contemplate freedom. And the, I mean, it's, we're learning about these astronomical, you know, events, but we're also kind of learning about ourselves, kind of seeing ourselves through a lens.
I think that's one of the basic structures of scientific inquiry too. That's very important, is that one of the basic things is that you share your results.
Yeah. It's a social thing. You have
very
to.
Social.
That's amazing.
If you don't share it, then you're not doing science.
Fantastic. So what other events that did we start to see and go, this is changing, this, and what did we start to learn? What did solar eclipses teach us?
Not just solar eclipses, but a lot of things we saw that were changing were things like people would start expressing in their artwork or in their writings about comets. Supernovas, when they went off, and you could see these bright flashes, and people would then be able to document and talk about these things rather than keeping the observations suppressed. Comets is a really big one, because it's not only is this something changing in the sky and actually moving, but they're stunningly beautiful, and you have to have an explanation for those things.
And pretty unpredictable.
And really unpredictable. Yes, very much so. Come out of nowhere sometimes. Something is very interesting. Something in my own specialty that's it's kind of crazy in that way is that impact craters, we see them on the moon when we look up at night and we see them in photographs of other worlds, are the single most common landform in the universe, more of those than anything else. Yet it wasn't until 1963 that we even accepted that there was an impact crater on Earth.
I'm wondering what really changed that mentality.
Well, we were getting ready to start missions to the moon, which would happen 5 years after that, actually. And they understood that there was these features on the moon. They wanted to know if they were from impact or volcanic features. And Dr. Gene Shoemaker, the world's first astrogeologist, actually, started studying Barringer Crater, Meteor Crater in Arizona, and finally concluded that that was an impact crater and not volcanic or crypto-explosive disturbance, as they call them. But that just shows you that we can make these observations other place and not apply them to our own world.
Yeah.
And now we know that there are roughly 180 surface impact craters on Earth and an unknown number under the oceans, but we suspect as many as 4,000. So that's a paradigm shift in our thinking about the world we live in and our relation to the other planets in our solar system and other objects in the universe as well.
And now we're really starting to take a more, a deeper observation of our own planet in order to understand those other worlds.
Very much so, because we have to have an analogy, a basis, when we go out and look at these things. One of the things that I always talk about in my astronomy class, my beginning astronomy class, is that when we look at the planets of our solar system and their moons, that we have to understand that we're the alien world. We're the world not like the other ones. And at one end, it makes us seem very special, and on the other, it makes us seem like the odd person out or the odd planet out. So those uniqueness about where we live also are the limiting factors that impose on us where we're going to go and what our survivability is in those locations.
So I know there's probably a lot of people wondering as they're listening to this exactly how we really fully understand and understand the science of all of this, how we can say our Earth is a great way, a great grounding place to understand everything that's happening in the universe, and we can know with all these certainties. What is it about the way we study? How can we have those certainties? What would you tell those people?
Well, it isn't that the Earth is the greatest model. The certainties lie in the process of scientific thinking more than anything else. That we have set ways we approach things. There are rules that you do to run experiments and run tests. So when you make these comparisons, you're saying, yes, I know that this looks like us, but can I see this somewhere else so that my observations are consistent and allow me to build up a consistent view that other people can test and that they can then also compare, and we can come up with either a similar observation or one may contradict it, and now we need to add and find out what's going on. It's a process of abductive reasoning, where as we add more material, we're able to draw better conclusions, and we're looking to see how the laws of nature work.
And we're learning a lot.
We're learning a lot. And I think, Gabriel, one of your a good way to approach this for your question is that there's an active search from our planet looking out into space and to other planets, other moons in our solar system for life. And what we have to be very aware of during this process is that life as we know it on our world, which has evolved on this world under these very special conditions that are unique to the solar system, might not be life as we find it someplace else. And we have to be ready for that difference. And maybe our opinions, maybe our definitions of what constitutes life. Mm-hmm. We're very careful in exploring other worlds. When we send spacecrafts out into the solar system, we try to sterilize them so that we wouldn't contaminate another place. And it's one of the reasons on Mars, the Curiosity rover's there. We think we see places that might have liquid water sometimes. And people go, why don't we send the rover and check it out? We don't know how sterile the rover was when it left here. And the last thing we would want to do would be to contaminate with Earth cooties a pristine Martian ecosystem. And so we're very careful with that.
It's got to bring our cootie shots if we go to Mars, I guess.
That's right.
That's right. Fantastic. So since we're on the topic of life, possibility of life on other planets, because I know everybody's always really interested in those conversations, I was reading a very interesting article the other day about the possibility that the reason why we have not found life on other planets is maybe because as a culture develops, it tends to wipe itself out. And we're looking at that with global climate change. What would be your thoughts on this as far as what we should be considering? What does exobiology, what does life on other planets teach us about, like, how we should care for our planet?
Well, the first thing to think about is that there's no proof that there is any exobiology yet. We like to think there is, that there are conditions on some of the moons, especially in our solar system, and maybe one or two of the planets that are conducive for life in some form, life that we might recognize, at least right now, probably microbial, microscopic of some kind. But we have to be really, really careful about that, and in that we evolved to live on this specific planet, on Earth. Our bodies are adapted to the gravity, the amount of solar radiation that we receive, where it's filtered through our atmosphere. The fact that we have liquid water is very important to us in our survival. A special temperature regime, gravity is big. Our bones and muscles are adapted to it. And it's not like we can just pick up and go to another world. We're always talking about going to Mars. Mars doesn't have an oxygenated atmosphere. It doesn't have an atmosphere really at all. It doesn't have a magnetic field, so it really can't hold an atmosphere to protect it. It doesn't have a geodynamo to make that magnetic field. It's very small in size. As a result, it has gravity that's about a quarter of Earth's. That becomes a very big problem for us to be there. You can't grow food there, despite what Matt Damon does in The Martian. That's not a real amenable place for us. And to think that we can trash where we live and turn our planet into an uninhabitable mess because of our behaviors, and then just go somewhere else and start trashing that place, is not very ethical. And I'm not sure if that's a really good idea for us to be doing. We need to take responsibility for where we live and prolong our own existence. Now, you mentioned that maybe someone on another world in another galaxy, we get to a point where we ruin where we live. We're projecting our behaviors onto a possible other culture. And that can be a dangerous thing. But I think, from my specialty in astronomy, that there are enough natural things out there that are willing to take us out without much care to what happens to us, that that's more of a concern. I think we need to worry about things like these 1,300 to 1,500 asteroids that cross Earth's orbital path, that are pretty good sized, unknown comets that come in and can smack into us. We have great records of this happening in the past. It's likely to happen again, and that other cultures would have to deal with a similar type of threats, no matter where they are. The physics is the same, no matter where you go in the universe. And it's pretty indifferent to us.
Yeah, it's a big, big space. It's a big space. A lot can happen. So... kind of going back to an earlier conversation we were talking about, as far as studying Earth, and we project a lot of the observable science. So if we were to look at like a random moon like Io, mm-hmm. and say, you know, we can say that these processes are happening. How do we do that? What are we using as our basis? How can we say, well, it's happening here on Earth. We're looking at these chemistry. How can we say that's got to be the way it's going there?
We have some really great observations on our planet, and we know how specific processes take place. We know how, say, like you mentioned, the geodynamo works, that if you have a solid metal core, you have a mantle of your planet that may have a liquid rock involved, magma, happening there in a crust. As the planet spins on its axis, it makes a dynamo that generates a charge, exits the poles, and puts a really nice magnetic field around the world. That allows you to hold an atmosphere so the solar wind doesn't blow it off. And we could observe these magnetic fields with our instruments. We can take spectroscopes on probes and spectrometers, and be able to tell what the chemistry of these worlds are. And because the universe only does two things, it does physics and it does chemistry, and everything else falls out of that. And as we have very defined sets of observations that allow us to have rules and to have physical and chemical laws, we know that those same processes, as we observe them other places, reflect what we see on our own planet. For my own background, if I'm going to look at images that come from Mars, say on the rovers taken in the Gale Crater, and I look at stratified rock units there, I know, because of the law of superposition and the principles of stratigraphy that we have observed on our Earth, that those rules have to apply on Mars as well. It's a physical law. It's a process that we've seen no exceptions to. And so when I see those things, I can make really pretty educated interpretations or interpreted guesses. And until someone contradicts that, we'll hold that information. As new information comes in, like I mentioned before, abducted reasoning allows me to change that and come up with a new hypothesis or a new theory or a different way to look at that observations. But, you know, if we see volcanoes on Io or we see volcanoes on Mars, we understand how volcanoes work here on Earth, and we have to apply that to those locations unless we find an exception to that rule. And those analogies then carry over.
Oh, I see. I see. And now, going back to the eclipse for a minute, we know that the moon obviously affects the tides, the sun affects the tides, and weather and climate. How is something like a total solar eclipse going to affect us as far as weather conditions, as far as, you know, is it going to change the pressure? Is it going to make animals act differently? And are those, if so, are those effects going to carry over to people beyond the awe? Like,
it's a great question because it does. When you're under the path of totality, it basically becomes night during daytime, and you will find that birds will roost, squirrels will run to their holes, the crickets will chirp, the bats will come out, the temperature will drop about 10 degrees. And because of that, there'll be a pressure change and the wind will come up. It gets really quiet if you've ever been in an eclipse, even a partial eclipse, because all the animal behavior stops and people then stop to observe. So all the normal background noises we see in our day-to-day lives seem to disappear for a while. Kind of a stunning moment. That's why people will stop and look, even if it's not, you know, you're aware of an eclipse, you know, something's not right. Now, human behavior, there's an interesting one. I mentioned before that some people sing, dance, and things like that. When I go on to give the talk that I give about eclipses, and I know other colleagues as well, one of the things we say is be mindful of your human behavior during this. While you might think it's very fun and interesting and will enhance your eclipse-going experience, most people don't want to hear your boombox blowing out Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Or You Are the Sunshine of My Life, or Total Eclipse of the Heart. That ruins it for other people. So yeah. We want to mind our human behavior as well. Also, many people will be traveling from all over the world to come, in this case, to Corvallis to witness the eclipse. And a lot of them will have very expensive equipment, telescopes, cameras mounted on them, solar scopes. It's really not polite to walk up and say, hey, can I look through your telescope? No. That's because this is their stuff set up for exactly what they want to do. On the other hand, you'll have someone like myself with all of my telescopes, solar filtered binoculars, and because this is a public university, I work for a public thing, our equipment's paid for, it's set up there specifically for you to come and observe with. And I want you to do that. I'm not going to tell you no. It's the people's, this is Oregon State University is the people's university. And these are the people's, you know, optical astronomical equipment. And I'm just there to make sure it gets back in the boxes at the end of the day.
So when it comes to ethics, respect other people, but definitely come check out Oregon State because we've got the stuff.
Exactly.
Great. So, and I want to be careful how I ask this question because obviously we're talking science here. When it comes to human behavioral change, we obviously know that, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, the celestial bodies somehow affecting how we act. But when it comes to an eclipse, how much of our behaviors or how much of that do you think is a subconscious reaction to, how much of it is the reaction to the awe, and how much are we affected by a subconscious level of feeling the difference of like barometric pressures and stuff? Does that, like, do people who, for instance, have arthritis, are they going to be more likely to have trouble? Is there any truth to any of that, like with weather and stuff?
Not that I know of. It's the event happens in such a quick succession of time. I mean, here in Corvallis, a minute and 40 seconds is totality. So I don't think you're going to find, you know, any medical aversion to it unless you stare at the sun, and then you'll end up with solar retinal scarring. We don't want that. I think more of it is psychological. It's a
placebo. Still
this, yes, it's also this very fearful thing that a lot of people still traditionally, whatever is happening in their belief systems or their lack of understanding of the situation, it's frightening. Middle of the day, it goes totally dark. That's not a normal occurrence in most people's lives. Like I said, this, for most people, will be a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence to be underneath the path of totality of a total solar eclipse. Yeah, I can see people being very frightened of this. You don't know what to expect. All of a sudden this happens. The conditions around you are completely alien to what you expect at 10 o'clock in the morning. So it could be very, I don't want to say disturbing so much as unnerving to people, and a sense of relief when the sun comes back. I think that is so ingrained culturally in our brains, our primitive brains, that I know, let's put it this way, Gabriel. I know that we have a set of GoPro cameras that we've bought at the Space Grant with tripods. And one of the things we're going to be doing is setting those up not to look at the eclipse. I can get 27 videos of the eclipse every second online probably afterwards. You know, millions of people videoing it. We want to image the crowds. How do people react to an eclipse? I know that there is going to be a group of people on Mary's Peak during this event too, and I was told that one of the groups have got permission to fly a drone so that the drone can hover and photograph the crowds on Mary's Peak during the total eclipse, just to watch how people react to this event. I think that's significant and will be very important as a research tool for some people.
Studying this level of social behavior, is this going to create, do you think that will create new avenues for psychology, anthropology, social science, where we start to look at human behavior in a different way based on these kind of events?
I think so. I'm not a social scientist, but I wonder how much work has actually been done on how people react as a social group or as individuals to these natural processes. I think that's part of our prejudice as human beings, is that we don't look at the fact that big events such as an eclipse, or maybe even, you know, a tidal wave, an earthquake, how do we react to that? It's probably a very interesting field of study. I would think that there should be people out there who really want to jump on and say, gosh, these, because then you link what you see right now, can we link that back through time? Are there historical records that have been kept, or even traditional stories that may link us to how people's behavior reacted to these natural events?
Definitely. Since we know so much about what's happening, and yet we still have this level of fear and unnerving, as you spoke of, with kind of, we anticipate that the sun will be there and suddenly it's not. And even though we know what's happening, we still have this unnerving. Understanding this would really help us to understand a lot of the literature that we read of ancient times.
Exactly. I think another connector to this is that there is a concern among people. I know here in Corvallis, we're working with this, Portland and Eugene as well, even though Portland and Eugene are not under totality, that people who don't have access to media, say someone who might be homeless, that are not aware of this event. And then all of a sudden on that morning, you get, in the case of Eugene or Portland, 99% totality. Here in Corvallis, complete totality, and someone doesn't even know what's happening. Their first reaction is to look up in the sky. And if they don't have the proper safety eyewear, this could be a very disturbing thing. So there is concern of that. I know here at the Corvallis Food Bank that they will be giving away glasses at the food bank for folks so that they have the safety equipment. But again, it would be a very unnerving thing if you're not aware, and all of a sudden at 10 o'clock in the morning, it goes total dark. It's, could be spooky.
I imagine, yeah, and we'll definitely see that. Now, because the sun is going to be eclipsed, there is a point where we can actually look. When we do that, because we can't generally look in that direction. Being able to observe there, what have we learned during total eclipses through observation during that point of actual full totality?
Well, it allows us to see, at least with our naked eye, the corona of the sun and the magnetic field entrained in the corona's particles, ion material and plasma, that are charged up there. And we can actually see the trails of the magnetic field. A lot of the information that we get about the sun, we have probes, the Solar Dynamic Observatory and the Solar Heliospheric Observatories that are up there. And we can get that information a lot of the times every second with a specific range of instrumentation. But this is the phenomena viewed with the naked eye. And that's why it becomes this beautiful natural phenomena for us to observe. We don't get to see it ever unless it's under a total eclipse. Other interesting things is back 100 years ago, there's a very famous experiment called the Eddington experiment to prove Albert Einstein's theory that light could be bent by a mass through the fabric of space-time. So people will be redoing that experiment. And people always ask me, well, why are they redoing it? Didn't they do that 100 years ago? Well, as part of science, again, we redo the experiments with better equipment. We're able to narrow down the parameters. New observations can be made with that. And you are also reproving in the past, so you're reinforcing the observation that this, yes, this really does happen. So that's very cool. I know for me, one of the most interesting things is that when we have our total eclipse here in another 3 weeks, or less than 3 weeks now, that we will be able to see four planets in conjunction during the eclipse. We will be able to see Jupiter, Mercury, Mars, and Venus all in a line at 10:15 in the morning in total darkness. And the interesting thing is the planet Mercury. Most people in their whole life will never see the planet Mercury. And when it rises and sets, at least in our latitude here where we are, it's only 10 degrees off the horizon. That's really low. And we live in a valley with mountains on both sides. So unless we get up on one of the peaks, we never have a chance to see Mercury. But here, we're going to see Mercury at 10:15 in the morning, and it's going to be almost 40 degrees high in the sky. And so that is really cool. All these people who would never see Mercury in their life will have a chance to see the planet Mercury.
How would you advise people to actually see these planets? Where, as far as like understanding the difference between them and other like stars, or
they will be the brighter objects because they will be reflecting light rather than emitting them. They'll probably be a slightly larger size. Of course, Mars will be red, but Venus will be, and Jupiter will probably be the brightest objects that you will see. Mercury will be just like a star, but it'll be to the lower left of the sun, and it'll be farther away from the corona, so it won't interfere. You'll be able to see it. There will be a very bright star just to the left of the sun called Regulus that will be in view. It's predicted we'll be able to see Arcturus, I think, as well from our position here, which will be, again, to the left of the sun and a little bit higher. But you'll be able to see quite a few stars. It's predicted. I know one person told me they predicted they could see 200 stars. I thought that was reaching. But we'll have to see.
Hopefully there won't be too much light pollution so we can see a little bit more.
Yes, I know here at Oregon State, where we're having our observations for people who are coming into the town and to the university to watch the eclipse, that we're turning off the lights. The historic lights around campus will be turned off. You know, the photo-triggered lights, say, at Dixon Field and things will be turned off as well so that they don't accidentally come on with a million candlewatts of light and ruin everybody's experience. We're looking ahead so that people who are here, they get darkness, they have a wonderful viewing experience, they can go back from wherever they came around the world and say that they had a wonderful and safe time of viewing the eclipse at Oregon State University and the city of Corvallis.
Excellent. So now there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be coming from all over, and some of them, like as you said, you know, we have the fortunate ability to have media, so we'll use it. What would you say? What's the best way to be safe? What kind of things should people anticipate for best viewing?
The best thing to do is to be able to find a location where, if you go outside right now and look to the south southeast, don't stare at the sun, though, but you have a general idea where the sun is. And that's pretty much where it's going to be in another 2 weeks. So if you have a clear view of that direction, that's what you're going to be able to see the sun. You're going to be fine. You know, check to make sure the neighbor's trees aren't in the way or a building of some kind. But it's absolutely essential that you have proper, safe eyewear. You need to get a pair of solar viewing glasses, which sell for a couple bucks here at Oregon State. You know, in different, when we're giving talks and things, we give them out to people. But it's very important that you look inside the earpieces when you, the inside of the paper glasses, that they have to be ISO certified safe. This means that standards organizations, ophthalmologists, NASA have said that this type of material in these glasses are safe. If there is no ISO rating on those glasses, don't purchase them. Do not put them on your eyes and try to look at the sun. If you end up with solar retinal scarring for some reason, that's a one and done deal. You are blind. The rods in your eye are shot. So we can't have that. We want everyone to be incredibly safe. You can go to certified places to buy these as well. I know online there are, if you go to the American Astronomical Society, they have a list of certified vendors that you could look up. I know OSU, OMSI, we have a specific vendor that we use that if we know everything's certified safe. You do not ever put your glasses on, your solar safety glasses, your little film and paper glasses. You do not ever put those on and look through a pair of binoculars or a telescope or a camera with a telephoto lens. This will destroy your eyes. It's the same as you taking a magnifying glass, pointing it at the sun, and trying to start a fire. This is what would happen to your eye, because the light is amplified through those objective lenses of those optical equipment right into your pupil, and you would fry your eye in less than a second. We know that binoculars with sun going through them will burn through a third of an inch of plastic in less than a second. So to put a flimsy piece of film in front of it would be bad. The only way you can look at the sun with a telescope, a pair of binoculars, or even a camera, a DSLR, is you have to have a certified filter over the objective lens. The big lens on the end has to be covered with a safe filter. One of the things that we recommend is if this is the first eclipse you've ever seen, don't try to take a picture of it, because it's going to be a minute and 40 seconds. It'll be over very, very quickly. You want to sit back, enjoy that experience of seeing totality and the corona. There's going to be a bazillion pictures online that'll be open source with people who have the equipment, the time, the training to take those images. So drop the camera on the ground and enjoy yourself. Don't risk your eyes. Have your safety glasses on. Don't try to look at reflections in water. Don't try to look at the sun with sunglasses on. These are all very unsafe methods and will cost you your vision. And we don't want that to happen to anyone.
Thank you for that. And obviously, you know, make sure you enjoy the social event that it is.
Oh, come on. Yeah, that's the whole thing, to have that memory that you share, like I said, with your friends, family, and colleagues, that gives you that common thread throughout human history that you shared in one of these similar events.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Milstein, for taking the time to be with us. I want to thank you all for listening in and tuning in to KBVR Corvallis. Anyway, the solar eclipse is going to be happening on the 21st, so be ready. And we hope you have a good time enjoying it with the friends and family that you'll be with. Thank you for tuning in.
You've been listening to an interview with Oregon State's Dr. Randall Milstein on KBVR Corvallis. For more student coverage on the total solar eclipse, you can go to orangemedianetwork.com. Thanks for tuning in.